Luke?
An agency generally covers all the organizations that help the president execute a law.
So any agency that helps the president execute a law. So the citizens' militia that patrol the border in southeast Arizona to help enforce immigration law as vigilante citizens is an agency.
There's certain criteria. An agency, especially if the executive has to be headed by a person nominated by the Senate, a president confirmed by the Senate, the agency has to deal with an executive's personality, and it has to specialize in a particular topic area.
So pulling the reins here a little bit, where is that coming from? When you say it's got to, you're implying there's something underneath there.
We discussed a little bit of this with the Humphreys executor and Myers decision.
Right.
And Morrison versus Olson as well. Mostly what I can remember is the textbook saying. So.
Good answer, but remember both those cases also dealt with quasi-constitutional concerns. I'm actually thinking that there is the Magna Carta of administrative law we've mentioned before. It's actually in your book.
True. The
Administrative Procedure Act. That is your black letter law answer. I can wave my hands and talk fulsomely about the philosophy of agencies and what one looks like and what one should look like, but when you're in a court, the APA is where you're going to look for your answer. Small side note, every state has their own version as well. So do not make the mistake of assuming that the Texas Administrative Procedure Act works the same way as the Federal Administrative Procedure Act. It doesn't. But that's a whole other class, a fun and exciting and interesting one. And I'll try and highlight a few marks as we go along. So what's the APA definition? Did Luke capture it? Or? Help your colleagues. Where are you looking?
Page 1063.
1063. So that's the first page of the statute. Okay, and you're looking at the definition of agency. Okay, excellent. So that's one you can circle in red and make sure to include in your brief or your final exam answer. So now everyone slap your hand over it. Ask yourself the following question. Is a court an agency? Is a federal court an agency? I'm saying Jack did not slap his hand over, he's reading furiously. This is page 1063. Section 551 of the Administrative Procedure Act.
Yes.
Yes. It's an agency?
What's it?
I might be pledging a bottle of single malt scotch from.
Never mind.
Okay. Okay. So think about the functional definition Luke just gave you and what a court actually does. And you'll realize that there are some arbitrary lines drawn. Courts are agencies in some respects, especially the Judicial Administrative Conference, which actually designs the operating procedures for the court system. But nonetheless, under the APA, it ain't the case. All right, for those of you who are playing fair, if your hand is still slapped on the page, next question to help clarify all this for you, what about the military, one of the biggest bureaucracies in the United States? Is the military an agency under the APA? Should it be? Drew's looking thoughtful. Mike's looking thoughtful. I'm sorry?
I would think Department of Defense, but based off the last question, I think it's an agency.
Well, actually, it's a little bit tweaked. All right, now you can lift your hands. They said we're slapping your hand on the page. Notice courts are categorically excluded, but there's a functional exclusion for certain aspects of military operations. So, for example, court-martials. Try to imagine the Administrative Procedure Act applying towards a trial of someone accused of violating the military code of conduct. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. So all that's a way of saying, don't automatically assume just because you're dealing with someone who has a GS rating from the government that you're dealing with a federal agency. the APA actually draws some fairly bright lines on certain things that the rules don't apply to, or they alter the scope of which part of the rules apply to it. Does that make sense for everybody? Okay? So, with that in mind, I'm going to ask another fundamental question, which is hand in hand with the same fundamental question of what is an agency, which is, what is a rule? And here I'm not going to ask you to slap your hand on the page. The answer is also in the book. This is my gentle way of reminding everybody that the APA is the appendix in your book, and it is worth looking at, because I will tell you, I think I went through all of law school and never once looked at an appendix. It was sort of a license to go watch cartoons. So, this is one that's worth paying attention to. The APA actually will give you a roadmap to answer hard questions for you. And if you take a look, the definition of rule is on the very next page, page 1064. Take a quick look at it, because then I'm going to ask you some questions about the hinterlands, the borders of it, and then we can start moving to the nuts and bolts of applying these concepts. And keep in mind, I'm going to ask for a volunteer to help functionalize some of these things we're about to talk about. So with that in mind, everyone had a chance to at least skim it, because here's a couple of questions. Would it be a rule under the APA definition if the agency basically promulgated a set of directions that must be obeyed, but they only apply within inside the agency? Is that a rule? In other words, is it possible to have a rule that only applies to a small number of people or only internally? Question number two. And I'll give you the answer to all three of these questions at the same time. What about a rule that doesn't do anything other than interpret a statute? It doesn't say anyone has to get money, get a permit, go to jail. It just simply says, we've read this statute, and we are promulgating in the Federal Register the way we interpret it to be fair to everybody who might have to deal with it in the future. Is that a rule? And third, what about just a general statement of policy? The Department of Justice will assure that operations by the special prosecutor will comply with all general policies issued by the Department of Justice otherwise. The short answer for all three, and normally I'd love to torture you about this extensively, but it is also black and white. It's in the next page, 1065. The point here is the rule definition interplays with the functional implementation of that definition. In section 553, part B, there are carve-outs, and they spell out when certain portions of the rules, the statute, applies to certain rules. So, for example, 552B, about notice, doesn't apply when you have an interpretive rule. You don't have to publish in the Federal Register. So, point being, rules are, they're not rigid. They have a flexible definition, like a beanbag chair. But they still work, and the statute itself gives you specific carve-outs you have to watch out for. By and large, when I'm talking about a rule, I'm talking about its functional implementation, which is a statement by the agency in furtherance of its statutory purpose that has prospective effect and binds outside parties. That'll get you 90% to 95% of most of what the agency does that would be considered a rule by a court. I'm not sure I can. Was anyone taking close and careful notes? Again, repeat what I just said, because otherwise I'll mangle this. All right, and Natalie's already given up a recording up here, so I can ask her to replay it like a court stenographer. So what I was saying is a rule from a functional perspective is a statement by the agency that implements the statutory purpose given to that agency, designed to apply prospectively to parties who may be affected by outside the agency. And roughly, hopefully there's enough overlap there between the two. Jack?
Can you not have a retroactive rule?
You can have a retroactive rule, but generally that has to be based on a congressional specific statement that the agency is going to have a retroactive effect. And I shouldn't put it quite so categorically. That's, like I said, a functional. Most rules are designed to apply prospectively for reasons of due process and just inherent implementation issues. Okay? All right. Any other thoughts, reactions, or questions? Because, you know, again, bottom line here, this is where the action's at. You guys will be dealing with agencies. You will not get everything you need in this class to work in front of an agency. I'll be blunt with you. This is designed to give you the basics so that you will know what you know and know what you don't know. If you are interested in practicing an area that is heavily administrative, labor law, healthcare law, Securities and Exchange Commission law, pharmaceuticals and health, pharmaceuticals and privacy law, environmental law, certainly, all of them, I'd strongly suggest you take administrative law. And you've got that message on Tuesday. So with that in mind, I am not going to talk about a couple of things. Number one, but I just want to flag it for you, I'm not going to talk about constitutional delegation issues. To what extent Congress can give an agency power. That is something I'm hoping that you've been covering with your con law class and the non-delegation doctrine. The other thing we're not going to cover, but I just want to remind you about it, is the appointment of agency personnel. Remember the Humphreys executor questions that we talked about early in the semester? Those concepts still apply. What I want to remind you of are the important things. The most important is the difference between an executive agency and an independent agency. Does that ring a bell for everybody? Y'all remember that? Yeah. I'm tempted to see if maybe I have some micro swag here. No, I'm not going to give you my car keys. But anyway, very briefly, just give me one thing that would tell you that something that an agency is an independent agency rather than an executive agency. What's a spot on that lever? I'll remind you, final exams in a month. Yes? I'm sorry, Michael, can you say it again? Even more narrowly, what is something that you would, that what is a feature of an agency that would tell you that it's an independent agency rather than an executive agency? Okay. I know where you're going, and I capture the spirit of it. That answer may raise red flags for constitutional scholars, because at the end of the day, remember, the president must have some capacity to oversee and terminate members of the agency. They can't answer solely to Congress. But it's all in the same spirit. Any others? They can be. So would that tell you they're independent or they're executive? All right, Miranda's right. Usually, I can tell you with almost a dead level certainty, if they're in the president's cabinet, they're political appointees, they're answerable to the president, and he or she can usually fire them at will. As in contrast, if you have someone who is in an independent agency, there are some other things that will stand out. Number one, they typically are fired for cause or have some other limitation. Second, you don't have one. Most independent agencies will have multiple leaders, commissioners, executors, administrators. Another hallmark is that they will be serving staggered terms so that you will see a gradual change of leadership no matter which party holds office. And the other thing is that with an independent agency, some statutes explicitly require that they be appointed from both parties. They mandate bipartisanship. So you can see wired into the DNA of an independent agency, they're going to function differently. And that's reflected in the Administrative Procedure Act in many ways. So with that in mind, now we know what agencies are and how they operate. We've talked about how you appoint them. For those of you who have a sadistic streak and enjoy watching the pain of others, I have put onto the website the confirmation hearing of Dr. Rafael Moreira Raso, who was the chairman of the Chemical Safety Board, an independent agency who was not supposed to be terminated except for a cause. And he was put through the most grueling oversight hearing to essentially pressure him into quitting. I'm surprised the man could walk after that hearing. It's the most brutal one I've ever seen. So I strongly, if you want to see how bad it can get, that's your worst case scenario. Go ahead and just fast forward to the end where I think it says Representative Chaffetz. I think that's it. Yes. I think he was the chair of the Oversight Committee at that time. Yeah, he summed up by emphasizing the incompetence of Dr. Moreira-Raso. Okay, so with that in mind, let's focus on now we know what an agency is, we know who runs them and the nature of them. What do we really care about? We care about what they actually produce. So in that mind, let me give you a little bit of an abstraction here. Now remember, to keep this real, to keep you able, I have to rely on my personal experience. Regulatory stuff is incredibly soul-suckingly boring unless you actually apply it. So I want you to apply it. What I'd like to do is to have someone monitor what we're about to talk about from the perspective of the handout I gave you at the end of class on Tuesday. Do y'all remember what that was about? Yes. Any mosquitoes? Genetically modified Franken mosquitoes. And I apologize for using that term. It's clearly loaded. But genetically modified mosquitoes that are designed to actually wipe out a particular species of mosquito that carries dengue, bone break, I think it's chikungunya, and more importantly, Zika viruses. So the question here is that they've now noticed in the Federal Register, and it's a reality, on April 9th next week, you have an opportunity to comment on this proposal to issue an experimental use permit to allow the release of literally thousands of these mosquitoes in Harris County at undisclosed locations. So with that in mind, think about everything we're about to talk about as to whether or not it would apply to someone who wanted to oppose or someone who wanted to advocate. I'll let you choose the release of these mosquitoes. So with that in mind, volunteer before I point the finger and volunteer somebody. You sure? Okay, I was already starting to randomly assign someone who hasn't spoken yet this semester, so you've saved someone. Okay, for your swag, this has little to do with the topic today, but I just couldn't resist giving it away. Since I'm going to be asking you to speak as we get to the end of the class, this is the Putnam's Ready Speechmaker. It's instructions on how to be an effective speaker, dated 1919. So it's interesting. It actually has jokes from 1919, and they are incredibly, now that I look at it, racist and politically incorrect. Yeah. I'm going to reconsider here. Unless someone really wants this, I'll save it for perhaps backup swag. Since we're talking about transgenic mosquitoes, it seemed to me that Calvin and Hobbes might be an appropriate place to set that in. So. Okay. So, as Drew's keeping track and is getting ready, by the way, are you for or against the release of the mosquitoes?
Oh, is that volunteering for that?
Yeah. What did you think you were volunteering for?
I thought you
were
telling somebody to think about it, and then
you're going to ask me to volunteer. Oh, well, I could. Does someone want the offensive and politically correct racist speechmaker guide?
Well, when you put it like that.
So, are you for or against the mosquitoes? All right. You've been approached by Oxitec Corporation. They want to pay you $5 million to advocate for the release of the mosquitoes.
I'm not ready to sell about saying no for now.
You turned them down.
Yes.
So that means then if you were approached by the Natural Resources Defense Council to oppose it.
I'll go with it.
Okay, so you're against the release of the mosquitoes. Is anyone in favor of releasing the mosquitoes? Before you go, Chad, you sure?
I did read the paper because I couldn't find the mosquito things on it, but I studied this in undergrad with
phones. Oh, okay. Well, here. Here's the Federal Register notice.
Here's the guy. Where are gloves? I didn't realize that. I put it out in the sentence that jokes. The first line is a color point.
Oh my God.
That needs clarification.
Yes.
So the mosquitoes that are being released are male mosquitoes, right?
That's correct.
So they're the ones that don't bite, right?
That's correct.
So even though they might be kind of a nuisance, then they would just disappear.
Yeah, the theory is you release male mosquitoes,
right.
They mate with the wild, the female mosquitoes,
right.
Only the female mosquitoes bite.
Right.
Both male and females carry the virus. And what happens is when they mate, the eggs will only hatch if you add tetracycline to the water.
Oh, so they'll all die.
So you wipe out 95% of the population instantly.
But it's not like the new mosquitoes can do anything, and yeah.
Well, except you never know. Genes move, genes migrate, species life adapts. Sorry.
Not that bad.
Yes. My question, are we not essentially?
Yeah, I think it's only about 95. But frankly, I'm curious if this was to result in the extinction of the mosquito species we're talking about, would anyone care?
Nope.
Emily, you would?
But yeah. I work in the zoo.
Oh, that's right. Well, if he's willing to share the swag with you.
I take the swag.
Okay. All right, you two are working together. I have to say, Emily, you're the very first student I've ever had who has said that they are concerned about the extinction of a mosquito. I mean, all right. That's all on the side. Let's keep our eye on the prize here. The reason we're talking about mosquitoes and the reason we're looking at this experimental use permit is I want to use it to illustrate the administrative process. So here's what you need to know. For rules, the key things are they come in different flavors and they come in different forms. So you really basically have, I hate to do this to you, a matrix. You have the possibility for formal and informal types of action. And then on the other half of the matrix, we have rules and adjudication. Pleasant, bloodless, abstract. What does it really mean? It means that if you're the warrior and you draw a ticket for one of these boxes, if you have a formal adjudication, you're essentially talking about an administrative equivalent of the trial, full blown. You're going before an administrative law judge or deciders. It is a situation where you'll have an opportunity to present witnesses typically, you submit evidence. The decision is going to be determined, supported by that evidence. It results in a written opinion. And you end up in a situation where rights of the party before the administrative body, that person's rights are essentially decided, just like it was in a court. This is by far the most laborious and taxing way for an agency to set policy. It's like common law, essentially. What you'll end up with is an agency basically deciding what it's going to do policy-wise, case by case by case, in a fully litigated position. Very rare as a result. Most agencies would rather have leprosy than go through this process. Usually, they will go and use statute or mandate that you have to use formal adjudication or formal rules, which goes through a similar type of contested adversarial process on the record. That's the important word there, quote, on the record, which results in testimony, witnesses, contested cross-examination, submission of an evidentiary record that supports a written decision by the administrative agency. So this is the smallest and toughest
formal rules are also, they used to be the norm, the way most rules were done. They have now been largely supplanted by activity on the informal side. On this, I have to say, the odds are the overwhelming majority, 95 plus, again, I'm saying 95 a lot today, 95 plus percent of HSA activity is informal rulemaking. And I'll explain why by walking through the process and how it works, so you have a sense of its malleability, its flexibility, its scope, the way you can make it actually work if you're an agency. You can also have, and I just mentioned this in passing because you don't see it necessarily, I shouldn't say that, you do see it, but informal adjudication, which sounds a bit like an oxymoron, doesn't it? What it basically means is that you can have an adjudicatory process that is not hindered and bound by the specific rules of the Administrative Procedure Act. The Administrative Procedure Act spells out in great details exactly what a formal adjudication must do. And if the agency fails to do it, even after years of effort and an extensive written record, they get overturned. Informal adjudication can incorporate the elements of a contested proceeding without necessarily incorporating all of the APA requirements. That's a complex way of saying, if you're in an informal adjudication or enforcement proceeding, you end up going before an ALJ or an agency officer or the deciders who are the commissioners. And you have, depending on the agency, rules in place telling you what their process is. And it can look like work, but oftentimes it isn't. You may not have the opportunity for live witnesses. You may have to give only written testimony in advance. You might have an opportunity to do oral argument. You may not get the opportunity for scheduling orders, dispositive motions. It's flexible, it's designed to yield a defensible record to support the agency decision without necessarily hitting all the constitutional bells you need for a fully contested judicial process. So for those of you who property, just to perhaps give you echoes of memory, Matthews v. Eldridge, remember, have y'all talked about that one? Property rights and administrative benefits.
That's the balancing test, right?
Yeah. A bundle of rights, yes, anyway, yes. That is, in essence, a case which talks about some of the constitutional constraints that leaves a large degree of flexibility as to how agencies could define informal adjudication. Does that make sense for everybody? Because, what is this box? This is where all the action is. Let's zoom in. What happens if you're in informal rulemaking? I'm going to describe the federal process right now. But it basically largely works on a timeline. This is a little bit what Deputy General Counsel Marcella Berg talked about on Tuesday. The agency essentially has a predefined template for which it undertakes informal rulemaking activity. The way you typically see it in most administrative law guidances and textbooks of people you talk to in the street is that the process begins with a notice of proposed rulemaking. What does that mean? It means the agency will publish in the Federal Register, which is the document of record for the federal government, that they intend to propose a rule.
Sorry.
I was trying to play some music there. Anyway, so the notice of proposed rulemaking will say the agency intends to promulgate a rule to set requirements for the thickness of leather in shoes. To pick something as off the records could possibly imagine. What the agency will do is they will announce in the Federal Register, they will describe who is in charge of that rule, the timeline for getting that rule in place, who you have to contact about the rule, and where you can submit your comments in that rule. Then it will have the preamble. And here is where I have to sort of give you the unwritten law. The preamble is where the action is. That's where the agency gives the rationale for why it's proposing this particular approach to the rule. Why it chose this pathway rather than others. What sorts of costs it might expect. The preamble is the agency's essentially opening up of its thinking process to justify the actual proposed rule.
And then the proposed rule at the end is the actual regulation, black and white, section 264.7, shoe leather shall be 8 centimeters thick. Does that make sense for everybody? If we're going with the standard script, at that point it opens a comment window. And then the comment window can be anywhere from 30 to 60 to 90 days. They typically are 90 days. They can be longer for certain rules, like 180 days. Certain emergency rules can be immediately effective. But the key thing is that usually there's a comment window. Anybody can comment. Kindergartners, people who aren't citizens of the United States, people who have zero personal interest in the rule and will not be affected by it anyway, it doesn't matter. Anyone can comment on the rule. Once it goes in, the agency then deliberates, and then at some point, unless there's a statutory framework that says it must be followed by a certain point, usually the agency has discretion as to when they publish the final rule. And they'll publish again in the Federal Register the final rule. The final rule is different than the notice of proposed rulemaking. The final rule not only has all the same stuff about who you contact and what sort of information, what sort of the history that leads up to the rule, it also specifically must have a preamble that responds to the comments received during this window. And then how the rule changed from here to here in response to those comments. Once the final rule is published, that usually starts the clock when you can sue for judicial review. Judicial review is what we'll talk about next week. All that came together for everyone so far. Hopefully, is this something you've run across other classes? I'm curious. Yes.
Does the rule have to change based on the comments, or can they just say the comments are worthless?
They can say the comments are worthless, and they can say why they're worthless.
Right.
I've also seen rules where no one commented, not a soul. In which case, the EPA, the agency will say this rule takes effect immediately.
So even though we're accepting to judicial review there, can that process start earlier, or do you have to wait until it's been published before you can report?
That is a very, very good question. Usually, under the Administrative Procedure Act, this is a prerequisite before you can take any further action and go to court. The reason is, you can't sue under the Administrative Procedure Act unless you have a final agency action. So this is not final by definition. It's a proposed rule. It may change. Anything that's published, you could have actually multiple proposed rules. It's not until you actually get to the final black and white final rule that you actually have a final agency action that you can sue on. And that gets tested all the time, frankly. If you have a major rule coming out that's proposed and it's going to have billion-dollar consequences or it's going to throw people in jail, people will try and sue saying the mere existence of a proposed rule is having consequences. Courts that usually say, sorry, the Administrative Procedure Act usually will only say you can do it in the final action, final agency action. Okay, good question. Any others? Thought I saw another hand. Yes, Becca.
Wait, so is the final rule the proposed legislation too, or is that actually what ends the timeline, I guess?
Well, proposed rule, you mean?
Or the final rule?
Yeah.
Is that the legislation? That's what they're...
The final rule is the final agency action. This is the legally enforceable text. And once the agency has done that and it goes to the Federal Register, at that point, it is the law of the land under the statute. You can sue to stop it. You can sue to enjoin its enforcement. But absent that, once the clock runs as to its effective date, you know, that's when it takes effect. Okay?
Is this all rulemaking or just formal?
I'm sorry?
Is this all rulemaking or is this just formal?
No, this is informal. Yeah, I want to be really clear about that. Despite the sort of rigid structure I've given you here, this is informal. Formal rulemaking, you'd be basically bringing your evidence into essentially a court-like setting. This is not court-like in any sort of way. Okay, Mike?
This is only the 80 days procedure.
The necessary procedure?
Yeah.
ADA.
Oh,
no. This is the general framework set up by the APA. I'm being weaselly with you because there is a secret that not a lot of people realize is that a lot of federal statutes have their own mini Administrative Procedure Act carried inside them. Congress will say, you know, we like this system, but for this particular subject matter, we may want to have an additional requirement, or we may have a different timetable, or we want to say you can only sue in certain courts. So you have to look at the statute itself and then put it side by side with the APA to find out what actual process it was.
I guess I'm trying to figure out how
it
could be sanctioned for like if you're trying to is that also a penalty process, or is it a totally separate?
I'm going to give you a necessarily two-layer answer for that. The executive order process, just in isolation, is separate from this term. This, the executive office, executive order process is a creature of the White House. It's not the executive office building, typically. It is not an agency action. Now, the reason I'm saying two layers is that there are executive orders that affect this process. And we're going to talk about those towards the end of class. All right. Any other questions? All right. Oh.
Something really similar with this form of thing happened with the FCC. A couple of months ago with the stuff?
Very much so. And keep that in mind because our next meetings next week are about the FCC. The FCC is one of the few agencies that still does formal rulemaking. And that's driven by statute. All right, any others? Okay, so I wanted to add to this because what you've gotten here basically is a cartoon. It's a schematic. The real process is actually much more free. I asked this with Marcella, Deputy General Counsel Burke, yesterday. Notice when she gave the 10 steps of rulemaking, this was step number 5. The truth is, as a practitioner, if you're no matter what field you're in, the real truth is that if you're getting in here, you're late to the game. A lot of the decisions have already been made. Once it's published, it's hard for the agency sometimes to change course. This is where you'll do a lot of your advocacy, your most effective advocacy. So how do you know about that? Where do you find the place to jump in? What I would suggest is a couple of things. One, I've put on the website regulations.gov. There's also reginfo.gov. The only reason I cite that for you is twofold. One, it's a great window as to what the agency is thinking about behind the curtain. There is what's called a semi-annual regulatory index. And what you'll notice is that a lot of them are not rules. They're not proposals. They are things the agency's thinking about regulating in the future. No deadlines. They'll be tied to a statute. But there's no statutory mandate. You can see things, literally seeing this, 12 years off into the future. By looking at what the agency has currently in the shop that they're considering, those are the ones you can zero in because the earlier you get involved, the more effect you can have. The second is that regs.gov and reginfo.gov both are incredible silos for information. If you want to find out about, say, genetically modified mosquito testing, if you take a look at the Federal Register notice that I handed out, you'll notice that it has an RIN, a rule information number, rule identification number, excuse me. If you go to regs.gov, or the dashboard, or the reginfo.gov, you can not only get that Federal Register notice, you can get every single comment filed in that notice. You can also get the background document supporting that Federal Register notice. So it's very, very different from the days of yore where you had to have a file cabinet with a manila folder that had the documents that only you had, and it gave you sort of a market position. Everybody is democratically in the same place, can all access the same information because it's pretty much very transparently put onto the internet now. Having said that, I'm gonna resist. I'd rather do this in front of you. What I'd suggest is, for those of you who are interested, first of all, the unified agenda I mentioned is here. So that will tell you basically everything that's going to happen. The reg review process will tell you what rules are going through the process right now. I realize I've just talked to you guys for a long time. Questions so far about how this is working, about how this differs from the actual sort of storybook version?
So the book distinguishes between rules and orders.
Mm-hmm.
orders and your rules, or is that a completely different process?
Orders tend to have their own process that are linked to the actual violation that's underlying the order. When you say order, I'm thinking about things where someone's being enforced against typically. You can also have orders, but here's the short line is this. Regulations are designed to apply to everybody. Orders deal with particular situations. And the process is different. And that's an extremely important question for our advocates on the mosquito question. Is this experimental use permit, even though it's in the Federal Register, an order or a rule? Does this process apply, even? And if it doesn't, what does? Okay, so any other questions? Okay, so with that in mind, the book makes a reference. Before I leave this behind, I want to flag it for you because the odds are very high. You will have a steely-eyed judge or partner or employer at some point in the future look at you if you're doing administrative work and say, wait, isn't this a Vermont Yankee issue? You notice that was mentioned in your book. What does that mean? It's not an issue we need to delve into because it's pretty much been settled. This case is like 30 years old now. What it basically says is the APA, the Administrative Procedure Act, and this process of this design, it's the alpha and the omega. It is not just a baseline. It also is the sum total of the obligations an agency must satisfy. What does that mean? It means that a court can't take a look at the way the agency promulgated a rule, and if the agency met the APA requirements, say, guess what? That's not enough. We want you to do more. The Vermont Yankee decision, basically the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. You can only say, see, and take a hard look as whether they comply with the Administrative Procedure Act process. You can't add additional layers through administrative common law or because you think it's right. So this is the window. You don't have to worry about people adding additional requirements at the end of the process, typically. All right? So with that in mind, this is the engine. This is the cover sort of black spoke of the rules. What does it mean in terms of if you're a president and you want to tweak this? You think it's generating too many rules. You think these rules are too expensive. You think that maybe the agency's taking the wrong path. Well, one way presidents have done that is through, as I mentioned previously, thanks to questions, executive orders. They've also been intervened with congressionally. So let me start with the congressional statutes. Number one, there are three acts that change this process, that add additional requirements to the APA standard procedure. And they're worth knowing. One of them has been particularly important in the past year. The first one is the Regulatory Flexibility Act, RFA. What does that mean? It simply means agencies have to now examine a statute, examine a regulation, and determine whether or not the rule itself offers multiple ways to accomplish the goal, and that rule is something that is necessary to achieve the statutory mandate. Number two, the Unfunded Mandates Reform Act. What does that mean? I'm sorry, Chad. No, of course.
Unfunded Mandate what act?
The Unfunded Mandate Reform Act. And what does that mean? Picture yourself as a legislator in Congress. You want to do something that's expensive. You don't have the money to do it. Why not just pass a statute saying, states, you do it. You raise the taxes, you accomplish the goal. Unfunded mandates became an incredibly controversial issue in the 1980s and 2000s, and the Unfunded Mandates Act targets specifically that agencies can't impose unfunded mandates without expressly considering the impacts of that decision and finding alternatives. And the last one's the best one, the Congressional Review Act. You may recall this from earlier last year when President Trump first took office. There was a window in time where Congress could strike down rules without having to worry about a filibuster. What does that mean? The Congressional Review Act simply says that if there is a regulation promulgated within a certain time frame, it has to be reported to Congress. Congress can pass a joint resolution saying that this rule is revoked. And then the president can sign that joint resolution. It has a couple of effects. One, the Congressional Review Act says you can't filibuster it. So things like, for example, major Obama initiatives passed in the last 6 months of this term by regulatory agencies had the opportunity where they could be rolled back even if there was no way to get enough Democratic votes in favor of it to join the Republicans in the Senate. Second, it also, under the Congressional Review Act, bars agencies from regulating or promulgating similar regulation again in the future. It essentially salts the earth. Issuing a similar regulation in the future. So if, for example, they roll back a rule saying that certain safety measures must be used in the nuclear industry because they thought this particular rule was too costly, the Congressional Review Act says, well, it's not just that rule, it's any futurely similar rule you are barred from promulgating. I'll be honest, we're still trying to figure out what that means. No one has yet challenged a follow-up rule as to whether or not it's barred by the Congressional Review Act because of a prior rollback.
Just in the near future, or like never, ever, ever?
My understanding is it's not date delimited. I'll check. I've heard some roughly saying that they thought it was around 3 years typically, but I don't see the statute putting that limit in there. Mike?
The Regulatory Flexibility Act said that agencies must examine the regulation to determine whether or not it authorizes.
Whether or not the Regulatory Flexibility Act simply says, is the regulation necessary and is there alternative ways to accomplish the same goal the statute sets out? Okay.
I have a political process question. Is this congressional sort of authority is mainly intended to be overriding a presidential veto? Because I don't see a lot of circumstances where, like, a president who is in charge of a regulatory agency would allow them to promulgate a rule that he would then veto or like sign the joint resolution.
No, your political process is dead on. The Congressional Review Act was basically trivia. You could, you know, it was a question that was rarely raised in reality because every time Congress would try and roll back a rule, if the president's agency had tried to pass it, the president just vetoed the resolution.
Yeah.
If you had a president who was elected to office who was at the same party as his predecessor or her predecessor, veto it. It's that rare circumstance where you have one president succeeded by a president from a different party, where the president had a large raft of major rules going through fairly late in his administration. And then it's pretty powerful, some devastating effect. And this is one of the rare instances where the Congressional Review Act had a very big footprint. Yeah. All right, does that make sense for everybody? So with that in mind, one last layer here to talk about. We've talked about how statutes affect the process. We've talked about the process itself as defined by the APA. We've talked about where most of the action is with informal legislative rulemaking, not adjudication. So how does the president oversee this directly? Remember I mentioned executive orders. We may end up talking about this at the beginning of our next class a little bit, but here's the key thing to keep in mind. The president has the power to do executive orders to make the agencies go through certain additional steps beyond the APA. And what that's translated to is that there have been a couple of executive orders of long standing, going back to the Reagan administration, renewed in the Clinton administration, again renewed during the Obama administration, which again is bipartisan, that say that agency rulemaking must satisfy certain cost benefit assessment requirements. In particular, Executive Order 12866 is still the workhorse for reviewing agencies. Now, the book gives you a quick overview. I'll give you a quick emphasis on the key points from that. And then we can talk about more detail next week, how cost-benefit assessment really works in reality and what sorts of weird effects it has, and raise philosophical questions about what's the value of a life, what's the value of not getting physically assaulted, What's the value of avoiding an extremely low risk of a catastrophic event? What's the value of a mosquito? So with that in mind, Executive Order 12866 basically does two things. First is a planning process. It requires every agency to coordinate with the White House and tell them what rules are in the pipeline and what sorts of resources those rules are going to require. Now notice, that planning process applies to every agency, including independent agencies, which is logical. It makes sense. Now, agencies, executive agencies, will typically have regulatory policy officers, appoint political appointees. The way that these typically work is that the political appointees will review whether or not a rule will proceed. And most agencies will not have a rulemaking commence without the regulatory policy officer's consent. And if there's a dispute between agencies or a dispute over that decision, under the rule of the executive order, it can be elevated to the vice president's office. So there's actually a dispute resolution process in place. So the bottom line is that for this coordination process, you have to basically let the White House know where things are going so the White House can direct traffic on it. The other part of the order is that it requires cost-benefit assessment. The rules' benefits have to outweigh its costs. That sounds logical, doesn't it? Who would argue with that? Well, it has some consequences. Number one, who gets to make the call? And here is where the most powerful people you've never heard of step to enter the stage. The Office of Management and Budget, OMB, you've probably heard about, they play a larger role in setting the federal budget and the White House's role in it. But within it, a small little secret, well, I won't say secret, but a little known office, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, OIRA, actually is the geeks. They're the ones who crunch the numbers and determine whether or not a rule's benefits exceed its cost. If you don't get it past OIRA and you can't get it past OMB, your rule ain't going anywhere unless there's a statutory mandate, it must be promulgated. The way it typically works is every agency has to calculate the numbers and submit a cost-benefit package to OIRA. And if OIRA doesn't like it, they issue what's called a return letter. A return letter basically says, go back and do it again. You could end up essentially in an infinite do loop. OIRA can't veto a rule. They can't say you never promulgated. They can keep saying redo the numbers over and over and over again. And some rules literally have been held up for years and years in this cost review process. The other thing that OIRA does is that they can initiate action where they think the agency's failing to do something by issuing what's called a review letter or a prompt letter. So these are pretty powerful guys. The guy who wrote the OMB circular 4A, sorry, A4, that's in your book, John Graham, brilliant, brilliant guy during the Reagan administration. The person who was head of it for Obama, Cass Sunstein at Harvard, another brilliant, brilliant guy. They have an outsized impact versus the small size of the office that they do. So the circular I just mentioned, it's in your book. It outlines the way you do cost assessment and review of rule. And we can talk a little bit more about how that translates into reality. We'll do that at the beginning of our next class. What I'd like to do is a couple of things. Oh, and we have a guest, which I'll get to in a second here. A couple of things. Number one, with OIRA's process, think about translating some of the procedures that are outlined in that circular about how you do things like valuing intangibles, qualitatively different things. What's the value of a human life? What's the value of an old life versus a young life? What's the value of dignity or rights? What's the value of the ability to participate in a process? What's the value of something that happens in the future as opposed to currently? These are all issues that routinely skew and affect the cost-benefit process. Number two. What do you do when you have something that's extremely unlikely to happen, but if it does, it's really super bad? To give you an example, the truth is human brains are not wired to do a good job of assessing low-risk, high-consequence probabilities. It's just a fact. So how do you do a cost-benefit assessment on a program which has been proposed to monitor asteroids that might collide with the Earth? What's the benefit and cost of that process? What do you do if you have someone who wants to inoculate wildlife to prevent the rise of a disease that might affect humans in the future? The sort of zoonotic pandemic issue. I'm not asking you guys to write anything or think about that, just raising it for you that this question pops up in surprising ways. So with that in mind, we'll talk a little bit more on next Tuesday about the cost-benefit assessment process and then apply it to our transgenic mosquito case as a way of tying everything together and looking back before we move on to the two cases next Tuesday. And I want to emphasize to you guys, these are two important cases. The Nova Scotia case is about an incredibly arcane issue dealing with prevention of botulism in whitefish, but it gets routinely cited as an administrative law case. And the State Farm insurance case, I'll tell you right now, affects every one of you every day because it's about seatbelts and airbags. And the Supreme Court, I guarantee you, cites it more than once every year because it's still a touchstone for administrative law. So with that, before everyone puts everything away and gets away, I want to take a quick moment to introduce you to a guest. We are very fortunate to have, sneaking into the back row at the last minute, Thomas Hester, who is the legislative director. I don't mean to introduce you, but come on and just come say hi yourself to everybody here. This is our first year class in statutory interpretive process.
Sure. Hi, everybody. My name is Thomas Hester, and I'm the legislative director for Congressman Michael McCall. He represents a portion of Boston, and his district goes all the way east to portions of Cape, just over here. So, glad to be with you guys.
All right. So, for those of you, remember the first third of our class in legislative process, this is the guy who lives and breathes it every day. He also is the one who deals with lawyers who are trying to influence that process. So if you have a moment or two after class and just want to say hi or ask any questions about that, hopefully we have a few months where we sneak away for lunch before the 1 o'clock class. So with that, questions? Last chance for anything here? All hanging together for you so far. Okay, so keep in mind, next week we're gonna be talking about, Yeah, next week. Next, transgenic mosquitoes and wrapping up the administrative process.
Professor
Hester,
yes. I had a question for you. Oh. The button. Yeah.
You got it.
Yeah. Stop.